Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. One of the conversations we keep coming around to on this show is about Buddhism, and particularly about the relationship between Buddhism and psychedelics or extraordinary experience in a variety of fashions. Not too long ago, Alan Bediner put out Zigzag Zen in another edition. This was kind of a groundbreaking text about the relationship between psychedelics and Buddhism in America. And it grew out of a special issue of Tricycle way back in the day. And so that was reissued recently, and we talked to Alan. And that was an important book for me because it was a place where I put out one of one of the pieces I'm more proud of that I wrote back in the 90s, late 90s, called The Paisley Gate. And it was looking at psychedelics in Buddhism as a kind of tantra. And, of course, the word tantra is a risky one to use in discussions of alternative spirituality since it means so many different things to so many different people. And I meant a couple of things by it. One is that it was a kind of energetic, magical practice that involved the uncorked imagination, something I think applies to both psychedelic experience and to a good deal of tantric sadhana. But I also meant it in the sense that for Americans practicing Buddhism, at least in the 1990s, when I started practicing Buddhism, I probably had my most intense practice at the end of that decade in the early 2000s. And now I'm sort of a Buddhist backslider or something. At that time, discussing openly one's psychedelic experiences was weirdly non-encouraged. And I say weirdly because as a historian, I was perfectly aware of the fact that the vast majority of the first wave of American Buddhist converts of the baby boomer generation got there one way or the other through the portal of drugs, of LSD particularly, but you know, everything that was available in that time. So it seemed like a strange kind of suppression that was going on there. And I remember one time I did a Dokusan, a kind of interview with my Zen teacher. And I guess my voice was, I have a sort of a booming voice, or the walls were thin or something. And I was talking to her, someone who I trusted, about psychedelic experience. And then later one of the senior monks came over and kind of cautioned me about appropriate discussions, et cetera, et cetera. And so I was like, this is really strange. It was, it's like it's a secret, kind of like the way in a traditional Hindu environment, left-handed tantra with its consumption of forbidden things like meat and alcohol in the context of heterodox religious rituals was really quite similar in some ways, where there's this kind of underground within Buddhism of people who continue to explore psychedelics, but it was kind of a on the sly. And I was delighted to taking the story forward, meet a number of years ago a scholar of religion, Doug Osto, who decided to write his second book about psychedelic Buddhism. And he was inspired in part by my article and took up my fuzzy, unformed ideas and turned it into a really wonderful exploration of this particular overlap, this kind of Venn diagram in Western spirituality between Buddhism and psychedelic spirituality. It's called Altered States, and it just came out. So since it came out, I got Doug on the phone. He now teaches, he's an American, but he teaches in New Zealand. And so we got him on the line, and we're going to talk about his book. So Doug, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Thanks a lot, Eric. It's good to be here.
You know, in a way, I want to, just before the show, we were talking about the book, and you take a very level, sort of non-judgmental approach. You're largely reporting your the historical situation. You've done tons of interviews. You have excerpts from a lot of these interviews. You have generalizations based on quantified aspects of the interviews, and you cut a pretty even hand. And we can talk about some of these things. We will talk about some of these things later. Some of the criticisms of earlier, call them more naive ways that people have tried to blend Buddhism or other religions and psychedelic experience. And so in some ways you're not suffering fools gladly. And you bring up a lot of scholarly arguments against psychedelic spirituality and against ideas about how people think about spiritual experience as a kind of source of authenticity. Some very important skeptical ideas that I also have spent a lot of time with. And then at the end of the book, there's kind of like this secret reveal of a postscript in which you go much farther than I have in print about talking about your spiritual experiences, on drugs with MDMA, with LSD, even sort of quasi-paranormal kind of phenomena or psychic aspects of these altered states, and how much that's informed your life and your interests. And it's a very interesting way of structuring the book, because on one level you could say, oh, well, it's just – this is what it means to write a scholarly book. You basically have to kind of toe the line and not show your sort of wayward investments in order to be taken seriously. But then at the end, you kind of wanted to put it in anyway, so you put it in. But I think there's something more profound there. And I think what it is that we're actually the work that you're doing and that I'm doing in similar and, some different ways, but is sort of about rearticulating what it means to have spiritual experience in a way that doesn't negate the critical thinking about these experiences, about how it fits into history, about how it fits into contemporary capitalism. So in a weird way, this almost kind of schizophrenia of your project, including this wonderful postscript, which is a great story. I really admire your adventures both in Buddhism and psychedelics. It actually points to something that we're participating in now. And I'm kind of curious whether, in addition to the scholarly project, let's trace the history of psychedelic Buddhism, let's talk to people and get some hard data, let's try to think about the issues that are raised, et cetera, that in addition to that, you were kind of trying to explore the meaning of these kinds of experiences on a deeper level. Was that part of your kind of intent from the get-go?
Yeah, absolutely. And I see what you're saying about the the possible sort of schizophrenic aspect of it. It's a real fine line, with the topic, because it is such a galvanizing and emotional sort of topic to discuss. And so much of the early rhetoric that you see from, the 60s is very much like, in your face, I had this experience, so it must be true. And so I didn't want to alienate anybody in the beginning, so I really tried to take a very even hand. But at the same time, my whole orientation, my whole approach that I put on, co-creation of stories and subjectivity, I felt like I needed to, in some ways, disclose my own subjective position. And once you start down that road, it's kind of, how far do you really want to, how far did I really want to go with it? And I think I pushed the boundaries a little bit. And I think we were talking about before the issue of placement, of how I sort of tucked it in the back rather than put it in the foreground. And I think some ways that was a way of balancing the two, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it totally makes sense. And I mean, I think it's great to have it appear at the end, where you're sort of reminded that, to say it again, is that you take critical approaches towards religious experience and psychedelics very seriously. And in some sense, you, you're not in the perennialist camp of a Aldous Huxley or a Timothy Leary in terms of claiming that psychedelics give us access to some universal part of the human sensorium that allows us to have experiences that are authentically identical with the experiences that are described in Zen texts or Vedantist texts or indeed what's happening with meditators in those cultures. This was a very powerful idea in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. It carried forward into the New Age, into Jungian psychology, which has another version of it through the archetypes. This idea that there's some kind of transpersonal dimension that drugs and meditation give us all an access to. And there's some very good reasons to find that really problematic. And we can get into some of those in a moment, but what I like is that then you're like, yeah, I've gone through all this stuff. I've gone through this critique of the naive ways of talking about religious experience, and yet the person who's giving me this information and who's walking through these positions with me is also someone who's really dived deep into extraordinary experience and in ways that have fundamentally changed you. There's a wonderful line in the end when you're talking about, I think it's an LSD experience of infinite love, and you quote your notebook and you describe this extraordinary experience of love and almost a typical trip tale, and then you sit down and you say, well, okay, we can criticize this or critique it. You can say, look, this is partly about this stage of trance that neuroscientists could identify, or it's about cultural expectations, blah blah blah, and then you say, well, actually, love became limitless, metaphysical, and cosmic. Such an experience could not help but alter the deep structure of my psyche and worldview. And that's the part that I want to ask you about in terms of thinking about experience, is that in my belief, my own experience, is that there is an aspect of experience, phenomenological, you could call it an encounter, where even if you can legitimately and satisfyingly deconstruct it in the future or eventually, there's something about the encounter itself that changes you irreparably. And it's a funny kind of change, because you can't say, oh, it's because I actually saw that the universe was made up of infinite love. You're like, I don't know that. I can't make that claim. And right. Yet you had an encounter of infinite love with infinite love, or something like infinite love, a simulacra of infinite love, if you want to insist on that. And nonetheless, you're a changed person. You're an open-hearted person. You're a very engaging person, and it partly has to do with your experiences. So I'd love to hear you. How do you think about that particular aspect of quote-unquote spiritual experience?
Yeah, and I think when I... It's about subjectivity for me, and how we've tried to sort of remove in the academy, and especially the kind of scientistic thinking, we try to remove subjectivity and how central it is to who we are. I mean, regardless of what necessarily your metaphysical or ontological commitments are, sometimes things happen to you intensely profound, alter you in some way, and involve some kind of altered state of consciousness. And I think I was sort of inspired by some of the interview work that I did, where people would actually tell me these stories of things that happened to them that were so core to, who they are and who they became. And some of these people are scholars and academics, and they write very hard-headed books about things. But this is stuff that's sort of in the background that is motivating and kind of structuring what they're doing. But you don't get to find out about it because there's this kind of culture of silence about certain types of experiences, because people, for the way that society or culture is these days, people are just not comfortable with talking about. And so I think because the way that I positioned myself for this research, I had very privileged access to some really profound experiences that people had. And it's sort of... made me bold, I guess you could say, to be a little bit more disclosive. And I think that there's no way, and at the end of the day, that we can get a final closure on what is the real ontological meaning or metaphysical meaning of this, but we can still recognize that the experience, the subjective experience of whatever it was, is real, and it's kind of made me into the person that I am now.
Yeah, and it's the way that I think about that often is in terms of well, to use a kind of Buddhist term, or it comes up in other religions too, but very important in Buddhism, is the notion of transmission. And I feel like I've sort of gotten transmissions, hits, glimpses, and, you know, again, encounters that just have made me who I am. And so even to deconstruct it, to think my way out of the larger ontological possibilities, to keep a kind of open mind, which includes keeping a skeptical mind, which I think is part of not only the psychedelic path, but the spiritual path in general, to keep that kind of critical mind always engaged, or maybe not always engaged, but quite often engaged. And nonetheless, I look back and I go, well, I'm at a certain lineage. I was born in a certain place. I met certain people who were themselves carrying certain transmissions. I had encounters with both with individuals and with compounds. And that's made me who I am. And so it's almost like I have to be true to who I am, even though I don't know if it has that the status of a true, authentic religious experience or anything. I almost don't really worry about that anymore. And just to run on that, you talked to so many people. How did you find people were balancing these, let's say, need to be critical or to be reflective, and also the fact that there's these extraordinary, sometimes completely impossible experiences that fundamentally change who you are? How do you find people integrating or trying to live with those two demands?
That's not an easy question to answer, because I think everybody's different that way, and so there is a kind of positioning that one has, you know, vis-a-vis one's society, one's culture, you know, one's position within a, you know, the socioeconomic hierarchy that will determine, you know, how they interact with others, what kind of stories they tell people, what kind of stories they won't tell people. And I think a kind of theme that runs through my book is that this idea of narrative and narrativity, and how, you know, how we do tell these stories about who we are, and there's larger cultural narratives, but then there's also the individual narratives. And part of what was exciting about me to write the book was it felt like that there was an untold story here, and I think this ties in somewhat with you know, with what you've written in Paisley Gate. It's almost feels like we're coming full circle here, because, you know, you're someone from my generation. You know, we're not baby boomers, and we didn't, you know, have our first LSD experience in 67 or whatever and see God. But yet we're the inheritors of that. And to, you know, to read some of the things that you wrote about it and the way that you were thinking critically about it, and kind of on the edge there, I mean, you're sort of independent scholar / researcher who yet was sort of upfront enough about, I mean, you don't sort of talk about your own experience, but the writing is such that I could tell that it's informed by your experience. So I think, you know, issues like that were just sort of kicking around, jostling around in my head. And I think that, you know, that whole issue of secrecy and what people choose to tell other people was part of the whole mix, if you get what I'm saying.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that whole issue, you know, I've been thinking more about secrecy from a sociological point of view. When you look at, let's say, you know, in a classic example, like an occult order, where there are certain things that you learn and they're secrets and they're held within. And then once you're in the order, you still don't know the inner secrets, and you kind of have to do work to get up the ladder. And then you find out more stuff. And, and that there's a way to look at it where there is a real power to these secrets, but it's not necessarily based on their content, but just the fact that they're held in secrecy. And one of the things that I'm kind of going through now as the conversation around psychedelics is changing so rapidly, and it's funny, I mean, I think your book is totally, you were totally right to take that leap, because I think you're actually going to be ahead of the curve, as in a lot of ways academia is really behind the curve, where lots of other professionals in different parts of society are more explicit about talking about psychedelics and their possible value, where there's still this kind of nervous Nelly thing in amongst academics. So I think you're really doing a good job of leaping forward there. But the whole issue around narrative and keeping secrets, I think, is really interesting. And as I said, one of the things I'm dealing with now as we move into this kind of more above board realm is that recognizing some of the value of secrecy, the kinds of what it meant to be part of an underground, you know. And that was like one of my things, is that I always had one foot in the underground and one foot in some kind of more visible writer, research, journalist, scholar kind of guy. And that role of this, the secrecy of the underground, just as a space, is really important. There's a great book about 80s underground rock called What We Do Is Secret. And there's something really interesting about that moment but it's changing quite a bit. So I think in some ways that aspect of the Tantra of psychedelic Buddhism may be shifting. But that said, talk a little bit about how the resistance to the psychedelic story within American Buddhism, is that an artifact of its attempting to become more mainline? Is it something passing? Will there be more of an embrace? Or do you think that this will actually just continue to be kind of a bit of a secret underground within organizations that don't necessarily want to talk about this stuff?
Yeah, and I think that's a really good question. And I think that, you know, and I kind of chart the historical developments of American Buddhism and psychedelic spirituality. I think that, you know, the latter part of the 70s and early part of the 80s were sort of definitive in a kind of distancing of the two subcultures. And I think a lot of that had to do with, you know, there's a backlash against psychedelics. There's a war on drugs. American Buddhism became more established, the convert sort of American Buddhism that we see thriving now. And so that it became kind of less acceptable to talk about psychedelics than it was in the past. But as you said, I mean, the landscape's changing quite quickly. So, and I think with, you know, with renewed research in psychedelics, and you have the kind of liberalization of drug laws happening, especially around marijuana and places like Washington State and Colorado, that, so I think the boundaries are changing and the parameters are changing. And so I think a big part of the secrecy, obviously, was because these things are, they're illegal in a lot of places, and so there's a lot of legal repercussions to their use. So I think that will change. At the same time, I think there'll always be more conservative practitioners of Buddhism, and then there's that sticky issue of the, you know, the fifth precept and how important that is to people versus not. That was a kind of question that was driving a lot of the fifth precept
being the one against intoxicants, which I love that little chart where there were, you know, the percentage of you know, people surveyed who support the first four prohibitions were, you know, pretty high, like 70-80%, and then you get to the intoxicants, it's like 50%. It's like, well,
yeah, exactly. That was interesting. And that was for people who practice, you know, Vipassana, Goenka Vipassana, which they tend to take a pretty hard line, and they don't sort of discriminate really between one over the other. But yet, you know, people that completed that survey, they weren't all from America, but they're all English speaking contemporary practitioners. Yeah. And there was something like 50% follow that one versus the other. So there's a kind of attitude that that maybe that one's not so important, or people are not willing to embrace that, and then also the question of how you define, you know, what is an intoxicant, what constitutes an intoxicant.
Absolutely. I was just watching a documentary about I think it was called From Peyote to LSD. It's pretty good. It's a Wade Davis documentary from the late 2000s about Richard Schultes, and you know, some of the familiar story, but there was some interesting stuff in it. And one point they made when they were talking about the peyote church, or really the peyote way, was that for, you know, individuals now in Native American societies living with all the difficulties they live with, is that the construction of peyote has nothing to do with drugs. It's like, if you're doing drugs, you're doing meth and you're drinking a lot of alcohol and you're smoking cigarettes and whatever else you're doing, and you're doing drugs. And then if you want to get healed up, you know, you're going to go to the equivalent of, like, you know, going to the monastery. Instead, you're going to go to a road man and you're going to take peyote. It's like, it's not a drug. It's a medicine.
It's a medicine. Yeah.
And it's a real big gap. So that is a really, you know, I think significant point, of course, how we kind of deal with these. I wanted to talk a little bit about perennialism, because I sometimes have people ask me, well, what do you think about spirituality and psychedelics? And it's like, I have this like really complicated yes but answer. It's like, yes, but
yeah, right.
Don't do this, or, well, not don't do it, like know about it, expose yourself to this idea of these ideas of perennialism. But there really is a lot of good reasons to take it, not just with a grain of salt, but to really, in some sense, step away from it a little bit. And I remember talking to Roland Griffiths, and Roland Griffiths, of course, was the lead researcher on the Johns Hopkins psilocybin study, you know, about 10 years ago, which confirmed the Marsh chapel experiments. Yes, suitably prepared people in the right setting can have quote unquote authentic mystical experiences, and when they do that, they go to some scale that's been developed in psychology based on some scholar from the 60s that says what an authentic spiritual or mystical experience is. And I remember talking to him going, you know, that's a historical artifact of certain decisions that were made in institutions, blah, blah, blah. Started to give him the kind of critical thought that, like, you can't just take that scale as if it's giving you a direct access to something that in some ways we can't know and we're always constructing. And it was funny. He kind of got what I was saying, and he kind of didn't get it at all. Like, there was a way in which it was like, no, there are these things that human consciousness does. These things can do it. What's the worth, you know, arguing about it? So in a way, I want to ask you the same question. I come to you, hey, Doug, I really feel like there's something really connected between what spiritual mystics and meditators talk about and my psychedelic experience. How do I think about that? And like, how do you encourage that and yet reframe it in a way from some of the perennialist ideas that are still very powerful, at least among psychedelic people and Buddhists, and a lot of Buddhists too?
Well, I mean, yeah, you make a really good point. And I think one of the issues is, and one of my criticisms of the Johns Hopkins experiments was that they do take this. I mean, they basically take the scale that, you know, that was developed by Pankey, who was influenced by Walter Stace, who was a perennialist, and they kind of rehash that, and they come up with this data. And I think I make this kind of off the cuff remark that, you know, one way we can analyze this data is by saying that the Johns Hopkins team learned how to give, you know, psychedelic virgins a really good first trip. And I think the point of that being is that, you know, terms like, you know, mystical and spiritual and religious are very loaded terms, and I don't think you're ever going to come up with an airtight definition that's going to please everybody. And I think a lot of the language that's used around, you know, things like mystical and spiritual, it's about the the kind of impact they had on the person that was undergoing the experience. So in a way, they're evaluative statements. When someone says, I had a mystical experience, I had a religious experience, you know, what are they saying? They're saying that it was very valuable to them in some way or another. So in one sense, I'm sort of trying to bracket out a bit the kind of ontological or metaphysical commitments. But at the same time, everybody has some type of ontological or metaphysical commitments. And so I think that's where my work begins to sort of, you know, bleed into these issues of subjectivity and of narrative, because what happens is, you know, I can sit down with you and I can tell you about the different experiences I had and what profound, you know, changes they made in my life. And, you know, and I might talk about my own sort of, you know, commitments, philosophical, religious, spiritual. But that's, those aren't really effective arguments. Do you see what I'm saying?
Oh, and no, absolutely.
Yeah. And when people get up on their, you know, on the soapbox and they want to make arguments based on the personal experience, I think that's where the whole linguistic turn that sort of happened in scholarship in the 90s is as a useful critique. I mean, my critique of that critique, however, is it kind of goes a bit too far, because it almost throws the baby out with the bathwater. It doesn't want to talk about, you know, experience at all. And it's like, how do we do humanities without without talking about subjective, you know, experience? So
yeah,
I don't know
absolutely.
If I answered your questions. They're kind
no,
of
no,
mute,
no. It's a great. In fact, I even want to pull some stuff out of it. I mean, one, that was something I really learned from your book in the way that I've been trying to think around these things was this idea when someone. You know, you're always situated. You're always, if you're hearing someone tell you a story about their religious experience, you know, you're in a situation where that's a particular person or a text that's telling you that. And then rather than, is to resist the impulse to go towards big claims, like what's the claim being made here? Why are they calling this religious? Blah, blah, blah. And to simply go, for this person, this means that this is an extremely important experience. That's all I really need to do for the time being. I think that's really, really healthy and really, really helpful. As is your questioning the high degree of skepticism you find in some amongst some religious studies scholars, for one thing, who are just unwilling to even dance with the question of experience. And in a funny way, again, your book does something a bit cheeky where you present these rational arguments against putting too much ontological authority in our personal experiences and showing why there's good reasons to be critical of them, why there's good reasons to even, you know, for example, you describe in a really nice way, you know, the fact that a lot of people who come back from a DMT flash just insist that it was realer than real. It was like so real. It's like no way was this just some weird thing their brain was doing. And you make the point, well, there's no way to know that this drug isn't like tickling that particular part of our perceptual apparatus that says this thing is super real. This is totally real right here. And you can't know that. I mean, there's this kind of skeptical problem that you really can't get around. So you provide a lot of these kinds of questions, but then at the end you kind of go, but you know, at the end of the day, the thing is that people do these things not out of rational reasons, and you're not going to argue people out of pursuing these kinds of lives. I think what you can do, though, is just what you said, is that you argue people out of taking things too literally, taking things too substantively, and handing over their power to certain other people who supposedly have the story or the claim or have some great insight based on some experience they had, which they can't really authenticate any better than yours. So there's a kind of healthy skepticism that then becomes part of the spiritual path, but it's not restricted and reduced in the way that I think a lot of those sort of more whatever linguistic-oriented critics, you know, have. Which kind of brings us back to narrative, right? I mean, it's like how you're going to still be telling these stories to yourself and to other people. I mean, what's one of the big stories you tell yourself? I mean, about your own experience, like one that you come back to that's a structuring narrative for you.
Oh, big story. Wow, a big story. That's a tough one. And I think one of the things that was so exciting for me about the study, and I mean, I don't know if you know much about my first book at all, but my first book was very much a textual study, classic Buddhist philology, looking at text and context in ancient India. I love doing it. I love that work. I'll continue to do that work. But when I started to do this and I started to do research with real live people, one of the things that I realized is that people are complicated. And people are not only are they complicated, but they're paradoxical. You know, they can hold sort of simultaneous, contradictory viewpoints, and they can come out, you know, one sentence following the next, without even batting an eyelash. Texts, they at least they try to give the appearance of more coherence than that. So I think in that regard, I mean, I don't think I can really give you a good meta narrative on me yet, because I don't really know what the hell's going on with me outside of the kind of the smaller narratives. And I think in the back, you know, we talked a lot about the postscript in the back, so that's going to highlight it for a lot of people. But I think one of the caveats that I give in the beginning is that this is just a version, right? And in that sense, it will exclude more than it includes. So I'm going to dodge that question, Eric.
I'm going to tell one that got. I mean, I'm not going to tell the story so much. I wrote about it. It's in my book Nomad Codes, which also has the Paisley Gate in it. And it's okay. A short piece about an experience I had at a Zen retreat of all places that, even in some ways, it wasn't particularly a classic Zen Kensho. It had elements that were not really Buddhist in some ways in terms of the way that the subject kind of, you know, appeared to me. And it was a very interesting one in terms of thinking about these narratives, because I chose not to tell anybody about it, including, you know, my purported Zen teacher at the time. And it was months before I kind of mentioned it, and then I would occasionally tell it, and then I didn't want to tell it because I didn't want it to lose its juice. And then at some point, a while later, I realized that I was kind of clinging to it. I was holding on to it. It had become this little fetish, and I thought, well, you know, maybe it would be interesting to try to use my writing skills and try to write it out. And so I wrote this short piece, and you know, I put it out there, and it's part of the book. And one of the funny things that happened, though, was that my advisor at Rice, Jeff Kripal, ended up writing about that text in a textbook that he wrote about religion. And what was so weird about it for me is that when I read what he wrote about it, he pointed out how loaded some of the metaphors that I had been using to describe my experience were. And I realized that now I could see more deeply how I was drawing on these kind of narratives around me in order to layer, and in some ways distort, if that's the right word, this experience. But at the time when I wrote the text, it felt really true to life, you know, it felt really whatever. And I realized that there's no way out in some ways of these loops of interpretation, experience, text, phenomenology, that we're kind of like playing in this feedback environment that you point out very, very clearly at the end of your book, where you talk about how the relationship between interpretation and experience is, well, you use the fancy term aporia. But can you talk about a little bit more about that relationship between experience and interpretation, or experience and language, and in the sense of what's the good way to think about that relationship that's helpful as we go forward?
Well, yeah, and I do make that point. I think it's an important point to make, which is that we can't, you know, a lot of the earlier thinkers, and this was sort of Houston Smith's strategy as his rejoinder to R.C. Zahner's critique, which is just, I'm going to talk about these things just purely on the level of description. And the point that I make is that there's no such thing, right? Because all our descriptions of anything are going to be loaded with our interpretation. So every description is really an interpretation of what's going on. And then the other aspect to that is that in some sense we have to admit that we're experiencing something, that we can't reduce in a kind of deconstruction, we can't reduce all of life to merely interpretation. We need, in some ways or other, we need some stuff, right? We need some raw data. We need a world that we're bumping up against. But always in that bumping up against that world is the interpretation. And we need to interpret because, you know, as human beings, as living organisms, animals, we need to try to make sense out of, you know, what the heck is going on, you know, for basic, you know, survival reasons, you know, what have you. So there's this kind of, you know, dialectic between interpretation and experience that's never going to go away, and it's never going to be fully closed. You know, it's always open-ended. And, you know, when you were telling me about, you know, this piece that you wrote, you know, in a way, and then and same with this book. I mean, now that I pick up the book and I look at it now, and I think, you know, I'm not even sure I think that now, you know, because we're always changing in this kind of dynamic interplay with experience and interpretation, that anything that we write too, once it's in print, it's only like a snapshot. It's like a Polaroid. It's just a photograph of sort of where we were at the time, depending on how honest we're being with ourselves at the time. And if you look back on it and say, I don't think that now, or I can see, you know, with hindsight, I can see where other influences were coming in that I weren't necessarily aware of. Well, you know, well, that's all fine and good, but you know, I think one of the points I was trying to make is that, you know, certitude is a dangerous thing. And having that certain degree of, you know, not quite sure, and that includes not being so certain about, you know, the powers of human rationality, is a healthy thing to have that certain amount of skepticism, but yet nevertheless, we can still admit from our subjective point of view the meaning that, you know, we give to certain things that happen to us. So. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. I mean, I want to ask you another thing about perennialism, which is that, you know, there's an argument to be made that we're specifically in terms of the neurobiology of extraordinary experience, whether we think of it in terms of Zen meditation or of psychedelics, is that as you know, we become more and more familiar and acute in our understandings of neurophysiology and the cognitive, you know, questions that are raised from that perspective, that we can see that we are moving closer to a kind of thing where we say, well, yeah, these things happen because the nervous system has these capacities. And when you give a brain LSD, these are the things that happen. Here we can show you, an fMRI scan. And the whole presumption there is, of course, this is something that's happening to all human physiologies. And while every individual is going to construct that experience differently because their minds are different, they have had different thoughts, different experiences, different memories, there is a kind of universalism in the approach of emphasizing the neurophysiological dimension of extraordinary experience. So what I'm really curious about, what's going to happen, is how the, let's say, humanity's informed kind of interpretive play that you represent and that you have helped articulate in terms of how we think about these experiences, but also how we keep embracing experience and all its conundrum, that we don't get stuck merely in a rationalist framework. And at the same time, already seeing it, there's more and more acute, developed you know, sometimes philosophically poorly expressed, but in nonetheless very perceptive forms of knowledge and claims that are coming from the neurosciences, which also kind of suggest a kind of perennialism, a kind of universal capacity of the human nervous system to go into trance, to have encounters with entities, to enter into, you know, other worlds. And you talk about this a little bit in your book in terms of David Lewis Williams and some other figures, but you don't go super deep into it. I want to speculate a little bit. What do you think is going to happen? Is there going to be a convergence of these models? Is there going to be always a kind of literalism to the neurobiology? Where do you see this conversation going?
Well, that's a really good question, and I think that as human beings, because we're all fairly wired the same way as far as a kind of neurophysiology, and so there's going to be certain commonalities and experiences, and this is where the David Lewis Williams stuff comes in, where he develops this typology of altered states, and I think we're only going to know more as, you know, with the brain imaging technology that we have and with the liberalization of experiments that are being done with psychedelics, we're going to learn more. We still have the hard problem in philosophy of mind of consciousness of how do we bridge the gap between, you know, my own subjective experience of what it's like, you know, to look at a rose or to eat my favorite ice cream or to be in love versus sort of neurochemically, you know, what's going on in my brain, you know, that gap between sort of first person and third person. I don't know where that's going to go, but I think that is a real fault line that I'd like to point out. The other thing I'd like to point out is that I think we have to be careful about reductionism, and a lot of people who are interested in science and neurobiology and things that have been coming out in this regard, they're still kind of stuck in this kind of very 19th century materialistic worldview, whereas, you know, a lot of, you know, modern science, quantum mechanics, etc., the world is a lot weirder than that. So I think we live in actually very exciting times, because I think there's going to be a really kind of fertile sharing information and cross-fertilization, but I don't see, you know, modern science bringing ringing the death keel to mysticism anytime soon, basically.
That's why, yeah, no, I also agree in terms of that these are very exciting times, particularly around these issues. It's a good time to be on the border land between discourses and perspectives. We've got about 10 minutes left, and I want to ask you one more thing that you didn't talk about very much in your book, and I'd like to preface it by reading something that one of your interviewers, Alan Bediner, who edited Zigzag Zen and has been on Expanding Mind, what he talked about after he had taken ayahuasca with a shaman in Hawaii, who of course was turned out to be Terrence McKenna.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and he says this is great. He goes. So, you know, he has this whatever outlandishly difficult experience. He goes, I said, what did you do to me? How could you do that to me? He said that he had a full-blown death experience, maddeningly frightening. And I love McKenna's line. He says, oh, you'll do it again. And I said, why? Because whatever doesn't kill me makes me stronger. And McKenna said, no, that which kills you makes you stronger. And I love that. It's great. And then Alan talks about how that becomes kind of a lesson for him in his life. Like, it becomes a major teaching as he works on life and death. And for me, as someone who continues to practice Buddhism, if I don't actually identify with being a Buddhist, and who continues to remain open to all manner of extraordinary experiences, is that my bottom line, the place where I kind of bring it down to brass tacks, is nobody knows what's going to happen when you're going to die. It's terrifying. The best thing you can do to try to deal with that terror, to the extent we can ever deal with it, is to go into hardcore spiritual practice and to take sometimes heroic doses of psychedelics. And so there's a connection to me within psychedelic Buddhism that's really kind of front and center about death and the way that Buddhism is a unique religion in its relationship to death. In some ways, meditation and and related practices are practices of dying or practices of waking up to your own process unto death. And of course, psychedelics with their phantasmagoria, with the terror, with the loss of self, is a site of a kind of wrestling with death. And indeed, people are starting to use them now to treat end-of-life anxiety, which I think is the most interesting of all of the concurrent research programs that are going on. So I'd just like to hear you talk a little bit more about that particular issue, about the question of death, relating to one's own death and dying in light of both, in light of psychedelic Buddhism.
Yeah, no, first I want to commend you on your impersonation of Terence McKenna. That was that was great. You captured the sense of that story quite well, as it was conveyed to me actually by Alan. I think that's a really good point. Death is a meditation on death, the recognition of death and impermanence is really a core feature to a lot of Buddhist practice, and over and over again in the people's accounts of experiences with DMT, there's this mention of it kind of being a kind of simulated death, and I think that's where for people who are intrepid enough to go on this kind of path, I think that's going to be definitely is going to be a point of contact, and it works both ways too, and because I think that Buddhism, with its emphasis on sort of accepting of death and letting go and sort of letting things be, can be a real valuable tool when you're undergoing these really kind of mind-renting experiences. I mean, it's definitely, as I say in the end, at the very end of my book, at the end of the postscript, is I've never been an advocate. For the very reason that that these kind of endeavors, they're a bit like extreme sport. They're not really for everybody, and they do have certain inherent risks in them. But that said, I think there's always going to be people who are going to want to explore those limits, and I personally believe that that as individuals, we have a right to do whatever we want with our consciousness. So I think you raise a really good point, and I think it's for people that I've talked to who are very into this kind of thing, I think Alan really summed it up, that there is that is definitely a point of contact there.
Yeah, and I want to stay with the note of cognitive liberty there, that sense of this is something that we have a right to do. And I think it's also that as intellectuals and people who write scholarly books, we also have a right, or we need to fully claim, as you have done, our ability to sometimes speak from personal experience and to make it clear that we don't take, that we're not simply approaching this in a reductive way, that we take scholarly arguments seriously, we take critical thought seriously, very seriously. But there also is, in a way, there's a kind of underlying thread, I think, of your book of a kind of reclaiming that in the midst of still being critical, that I think, at least for someone like me, is really a kind of important lesson. And I think that it also points to something really important about spirituality and psychedelics, is that I don't think we need to think about psychedelics as being religious in order to have the right to take them. We don't need to think about them as being, we don't need to say they're like peyote for the Native Americans. We don't need to say they're like, it's like ayahuasca for the Indians in the jungle. It's like we can just take them out of our own interest, our own philosophical drive, our own drive to have experience. So I really like that note of cognitive liberty.
Yeah, and I think it's an important one that, and what people choose to do in their religion. I mean, it's one of the cornerstones of, American democracy is that we have a right to practice our religion. But further than that, we also have a right to have a say over our own consciousness and our own bodies, that and this kind of paternalistic approach that government has, that somehow we're not able to do that, or we need legislation for our own good. I don't think it's served anybody well. And
Yeah.
I think having a medical model, like if you look at places like Portugal that sort of pretty much decriminalized everything, is I think if we start looking at in terms of giving people help that they need who have problems with addiction, and letting people do what they want with their consciousness, is going to be overall better for everybody, really.
Good. Well, I think we're going to have to end on that
Okay.
that hopeful note. So, Doug,
Cool.
thanks so much for being with us and Expanding Mind.
Thanks a lot, Eric. I really enjoyed it.
Great, great. And Doug's book again is "Altered States: Buddhism and Psychedelic Spirituality in America." Tune in next week. We'll be talking to Dave McConnick about Bucky Fuller and cosmic displays in the sky. So, till then, keep your minds open.